This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as more details about the NSA surveillance program emerge, lawmakers and privacy advocates question the accuracy of recent testimony from government officials. Pressure mounts on Egypt's President Mohamed Morsi as protesters fill Cairo streets ahead of a military-imposed deadline to resolve the conflict. And it's day two of a transit strike in the San Francisco Bay Area.
You are part of a struggle that's going on throughout this country, in Michigan, in Texas, in Wisconsin, and even in Puerto Rico. A struggle to protect the middle class and the American dream.
Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Hundreds of people are expected at the Texas Capitol tonight as a House committee in special session holds a hearing on controversial anti-abortion legislation. FSRN's Teddy Wilson has more.
Witnesses will each be given 3 minutes to testify at the Texas House State Affairs Committee at a hearing scheduled to last until midnight. The committee is considering anti-abortion legislation that's identical to the bill defeated last week by Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis's filibuster and reproductive rights activist protest. Democratic State Senator Letitia Vandepute spoke to a crowd of thousands yesterday outside the Capitol.
Last week, you stood with Wendy. This week, you stand with Texas women. Don't you ever sit down!
Senator Davis was also there. The bill includes strict regulations that would close down 37 of the state's 42 facilities that provide abortion services. Most are in rural areas. According to Stacey Guidry, a reproductive rights activist with Stand With Texas Women, if enacted, the measure would have a harmful effect on women's health around the state. A 30-day special session of the Texas legislature began yesterday, and the first floor vote is expected next week. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, Texas.
Protests outside a police station in Ukraine continued today after authorities refused to arrest one of two police officers accused in a gang rape. Last night, residents of a town south of Kiev stormed the station, demanding the officer's detention. Last Wednesday, a 29-year-old woman was brutally attacked and sexually assaulted by three men. She identified her attackers, two police officers and a driver. One officer and the driver were arrested and then released. They were rearrested after public outcry. A prosecutor and two area police officials have been fired for their inadequate response to the charges. President Viktor Yanukovych, to whom many Ukrainians attribute an increase of corruption and impunity, has now ordered an investigation. A Palestinian youth died today during clashes with Israeli troops in the West Bank town of Dura. The Israeli military confirmed that soldiers fired on the youth, saying he had climbed onto their jeep. Ghassan Banura reports on eyewitness accounts of the incident.
19-year-old Mu'taz Sharawna was critically injured by a military vehicle and later died of his wounds at a local hospital. Eyewitnesses said that Sharawna climbed into a military jeep during an invasion targeting his town. Soldiers driving the jeep accelerated, throwing him to the ground and running over him. Clashes followed and another youth was slightly injured. Dozens more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Sharawna, a student at a Palestinian security college in Jericho, is the 19th Palestinian to die during West Bank clashes with the Israeli military since the beginning of the year. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
The trial of George Zimmerman, accused of killing an unarmed 17-year-old black youth, continued for the sixth day in Sanford, Florida. Today, the prosecution called the lead homicide investigator in the case. Detective Chris Serino testified that he believed George Zimmerman when he described his version of what happened the night he shot and killed Trayvon Martin.
Either he was telling the truth or he was a complete pathological liar.
Is there anything else in this case where you got the insight that he might be a pathological liar?
No.
The judge later struck the testimony from the record. Jurors have heard testimony from the friend with whom Trayvon was on the phone at the time of the incident, witnesses who heard someone calling for help, and audio experts, as well as the 911 call on which the fatal gunshot is heard. The trial before an all-female, predominantly white jury is expected to last 4 to 6 weeks. Europe continues to steam over the latest allegations of American spying on EU officials amid growing demands to postpone U.S.-EU trade talks slated to begin on Monday. Meanwhile, French political parties on both the left and right are calling for fugitive American whistleblower Edward Snowden to be offered asylum in France. FSRN's Leah Moriarty has more.
Still holed up at an airport in Moscow, Snowden has reportedly requested political asylum from 21 countries, including China, Venezuela, and France. In France, Jean-Luc Mélenchon of the Left Party told BFM TV that Snowden has done France a service.
It's thanks to him that we know that we have been spied on. It's not acceptable that we allow a situation whereby he wanders uncertainly around the planet. He is a defender of freedom.
Marine Le Pen, head of the far-right National Front, and the Green Party, currently in a coalition with the ruling socialists, are also calling for France to take Snowden in. For his part, President François Hollande has simply said that the French government has not yet received any official request for asylum from Snowden. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
Snowden has asked 21 countries for political asylum. At least 5 refused, citing requirements that the applicant be in their legal territory when the request is made. India and Brazil flat turned him down, and Poland said it would have too if his application had been properly filed. China hasn't responded. Bolivia and Venezuela are his likeliest bets. Snowden withdrew his request to Russia after President Vladimir Putin stipulated yesterday that the former security contractor would have to stop releasing classified information. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. As more details emerge about the documents leaked by U.S. intelligence analyst Edward Snowden, the Obama administration is publicly defending the secret spying programs as legal and necessary, but civil liberties and constitutional law experts disagree, saying the surveillance of both U.S. citizens and representatives of foreign governments living in the U.S. violates privacy protections in the Fourth Amendment. The leaked documents have also revealed that testimony administration officials gave to Congress this year about the scope of the surveillance was false. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
As President Obama continued a tour of Africa this week, he was asked at a press conference in Tanzania to respond to revelations that his government has been bugging European Union offices in New York and Washington, D.C., and tapping into their computer systems.
Every intelligence service, not just ours, but every European intelligence service, every Asian intelligence service, wherever there's an intelligence service, here's one thing that they're going to be doing. They're going to be trying to understand the world better and what's going on in world capitals around the world from sources that aren't available through the New York Times or NBC News, that they are seeking additional insight beyond what's available through open sources. And if that weren't the case, then there'd be no use for an intelligence service.
Yet the discovery that the U.S. has been spying on these offices has sparked anger from EU officials and leaders of its member countries, who have called the actions shocking and unacceptable. Some legal experts, including Executive Director Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, says the surveillance may also violate the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution.
Constitutional rights are due not only to citizens, but all persons in the U.S., and that also is a very clear commitment that we have long been proud of.
Buttar said President Obama's defense of the program, which rested on the assertion that most other countries carry out similar surveillance, is neither proven nor relevant.
Other countries' practices don't set the baseline for the United States, and we have long been proud of that, right? And it is profoundly disappointing to see President Obama defending this program rather than doing his job and fixing these abuses.
26 senators wrote last week to the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who was in charge of overseeing many of the programs outlined in the documents leaked by Edward Snowden. The senators demanded that Clapper and other federal intelligence officials publicly answer several questions, including, how long has the NSA used the Patriot Act to collect data on U.S. citizens? Have they been collecting other records besides phone records? Has this information ever been useful in stopping a terror plot? And how many people, including private contractors, have access to the data? They also accused Clapper of misleading the public about these programs, citing his testimony before a Senate committee in March in which he said the National Security Agency does not collect any type of data on millions of Americans. This was proven false in June when The Guardian published government requests for phone records of millions of Verizon customers. On June 21st, Director Clapper wrote to the Senate Intelligence Committee and admitted his answer was, quote, clearly erroneous. In the letter, which became public on the National Intelligence Agency's website on Tuesday, he went on to say that he reported his error to the committee soon after the hearing, but could only publicly admit it once the phone record collection program was declassified.
And it's Congress's job to provide oversight to the executive branch. And if they're not being truthful, then it's impossible to hold them to account.
That's Trevor Tim with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has been fighting legal battles with the Obama and Bush administrations for many years, seeking more information about government surveillance. He told FSRN the documents leaked by Snowden have been important, but the public still needs to know how laws like the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act are being implemented, and how many people are being monitored.
You know, we still don't know the scope of all of these programs, how many programs there are, and if there are more. So this is information that is critical to inform the public so that we can have an educated public debate on this subject.
As The Guardian promises more major reports in the coming weeks, the U.S. military has restricted or entirely blocked their website for service members on bases in the U.S. and overseas. Journalist Glenn Greenwald, who received the leaked documents from Snowden, said in his speech to the Socialism Conference this weekend that he's, quote, very humbled and honored by the military's move. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Transit workers in the San Francisco Bay Area continue day two of a strike after recent talks broke down. It's the first strike in more than 15 years, and the Bay Area Rapid Transit System's two largest unions say they're fighting for better wages and improved safety. From KPFA, Eileen Alfandari reports.
Union leaders say BART workers made major concessions during the Great Recession and need to recoup some lost ground. Doris Collier is a BART train operator with 22 years on the job.
We're not out here because we want to be. We're out here because we have to be.
The unions and BART management are far apart on wages, pensions, health care, and safety conditions. BART says it needs to invest more money into repairs and providing more cars for the aging system. It normally carries 400,000 passengers a day. The International Secretary Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union addressed a rally for striking workers. Eliseo Medina linked their action to struggles by a broader movement.
You are part of a struggle that's going on throughout this country, in Michigan, in Texas, in Wisconsin, and even in Puerto Rico, a struggle to protect the middle class and the American dream.
But the message may not be getting through to frustrated Bay Area commuters who expressed mixed views on the BART strike.
They got the right to do whatever they like, and I'm thinking they need to do whatever they have to do.
I don't think it's very fair of them to be asking for more when they have so much already, and it's very inconvenient for other people.
I don't know all the details, so I don't know what side to support. I just hope that there's a good reason for the strike.
I'm actually an SEIU union member myself for the state, but I'm kind of shocked they allowed this one to happen.
The two unions, SEIU Local 10-1 and Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1555, represent about 2,400 BART workers. No new talks are scheduled. Eileen Alfandari, FSRN, Berkeley.
This Thursday, July 4th, FSRN sits down with professor, author, and historian Noam Chomsky.
You know, it sounds reformist, but it's revolutionary.
We'll discuss worker-run collectives and sit-down strikes.
We're the ones who know how to run the place, so let's run it and kick out the bosses. You know, that's only one step away.
And we'll explore the impact of the ruling elite, propaganda, and mainstream media.
It's a distorting prism with enormous impact.
An exclusive interview with Noam Chomsky, that's this Thursday, July 4th, on Free Speech Radio News. In Egypt today, both supporters of President Mohamed Morsi and those calling for his ouster rallied in Cairo's streets as a military-imposed deadline to resolve the standoff nears. Sound from the AP, the military has given Morsi until tomorrow to agree on a plan with opposition leaders. Morsi's foreign minister resigned today following five other high-level cabinet resignations in recent days. For more, we're joined by Gada Talhami, emeritus professor in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest College. Her books include Palestine and the Egyptian National Identity. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
President Morsi is dealing with two separate deadlines. There was a 5 p.m. call for him to step down that came and went today. It was called for by protesters with Tamarod. The military has imposed a deadline for tomorrow for him to come to some kind of agreement with opposition forces. What needs to happen to avert the military stepping in?
Well, I think the opposition are calling for a specific step, which is the resignation of the Morsi government, to be followed by calling on the head of the Egyptian Constitutional Court to head some kind of a caretaker government and maybe to name a prime minister. Now that's the rub here, is how we're going to come up with a consensus figure that appeals to all the different and various factions of the opposition.
Now, the Muslim Brotherhood has called the military's deadline a coup, pointing out that Morsi was elected in a democratic election. As you note, the opposition is calling for someone who can be agreed upon to come in, maybe from the Constitutional Court. Is this a coup?
Well, I think Western observers have called it a coup, or a coup in stages, that it's the first step to a full-fledged intervention by the military. This is the most important question here, is whether or not to trust the military's word as to how long they plan to actually stay in office. This is not the first time that the military intervened in Egypt's politics. They were certainly the main force behind the 1952 revolution, which ended the monarchy, and they stayed in power literally until President Sadat came into office in 1970. But they did call for elections in the 60s. So I think the Egyptian public are prepared somehow for the army to play a nationalist role. That is, a role either to end, as they did in the past, feudal conditions, or now in this present time to end the prospect of a civil war, which everybody feels is really imminent, between the Brotherhood and the opposition. So, you know, in Western countries, anytime the military intervenes, it's usually suspect. I think in Egypt in particular, the army still has nationalist credentials. As you have seen yesterday in Tahrir Square, when people actually celebrated as they saw helicopters, army helicopters flying overhead.
Well, there were various reactions to the military announcing this deadline. There are various forces that are taking part in the massive protests that started Sunday and have continued through this week. Some are more pro-military. Some have ties to the former rule of Hosni Mubarak. Others, such as the grassroots groups that have led the call against Morsi, are those with Tamarod, and that's the campaign that called for Morsi to step down. FSRN spoke to Rayham Ibrahim, a journalist and member of the group's steering committee, in June when the campaign was getting started.
The campaign was formed by random youth who refuse the policies of Mohamed Morsi and who are rebelling against the status in Egypt, such as the policies to kill protesters, arrest political activists, the same strategies that were used before the revolution. When we revolted against Hosni Mubarak, it wasn't because of him, it was the conditions and the political life. It is the same now. We are rebelling against Morsi by trying to collect more than the number of votes that Morsi received in the election. So we can say that more people than elected you want you to leave. This is the main aim of the campaign.
Gharat Alhami, Tamarud has outlined a series of specific issues they are responding with. The forces of these millions of people who signed this signature, what is that influence moving forward?
Well, this is very important, and it's the first time it ever happened in Egypt, and I think it indicates a degree of political sophistication and perhaps a globalized vision on the part of the youth so that they're really aware of the recall movement that we have in this country. They do know, apparently, that you can collect signatures, but of course in our country these have to be at least 25% of the votes of the person they're trying to drive out, to be followed by elections. Now, so they're insisting on elections, and they demonstrated in the streets, I think, very clearly that this current government has lost legitimacy and has lost the support of the people. But I don't think we should look at them simply as young youth who are carried forward by their own enthusiasm. It is very clear that there are also political parties engaged with them, particularly Mohamed Baradei's, the Constitutional Party, and the socialist candidate who really is carrying the mantle of Nasser, somebody by the name of Hamdine Sabahi. But I don't think they're the driving force, and I think we should recognize that the driving force are those two political parties plus a large number of simply secular, liberal, young people, women, workers, Christians, minorities, who are objecting to something fundamental. And they've said it actually already to some reporters. And that is the imposition of different values, Islamist values on them. Now, these are all, probably all the majority of them, are Muslims. But being a Muslim and being an Islamist are two different things. And of course, people are calling for a secular government, simply meaning separation of mosque and state, so that we can have something progressive to move forward with.
Gharat Alhami is Emeritus Professor in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest College. Her books include Palestine and the Egyptian National Identity, also the Mobilization of Muslim Women in Egypt. Professor Talhami, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Palestinian activists in Gaza have been speaking out against a range of issues: the Israeli siege, the treatment of prisoners held in Israeli prisons, and the Hamas-led government's recent attempts to implement religious policies. But for women, the freedom to express themselves and engage in political activities is largely limited. In the conservative, male-dominated society, it can be challenging for women to take their voices to the street. But through social media, they are finding other means. FSRN's Lena Oldgaard reports from Gaza.
In a living room in the Gaza neighborhood, Al-Shajaya, Malika Mohammed's fingers dance over her computer keyboard as she types 140-character tweets. She then checks her Facebook page for comments from her 5,000-plus followers before clicking over to her blog to look over her latest post. The 22-year-old is one of Gaza's leading online activists, and she spends most of her time behind the computer. She arranges online campaigns or participates in conference calls where she advocates for the release of Palestinian prisoners, which is her main area of activism.
Whenever I want to write anything or to reply or even to comment, I always think of the effects. You can't see many Palestinian bloggers in Gaza, especially. Yani. So this is like a huge responsibility. And if you see like what Palestinian women blog about, it's mainly politics. You will not have someone blog about love, for example, about what kinds of food do you like. The reality, the main yani issue has rendered us into this kind of work.
There are only about a dozen regular female bloggers here, but Heba Sayan from UN Women in Gaza sees more and more girls and women turn to social networks to voice their opinions. While blogger Malika Mohammed says she doesn't face any problems speaking her mind online, Sayan says there are obstacles when women want to take their voices from the internet to the streets.
I've been seeing young women criticizing the government and everything else that's happening around them very, very strongly. It doesn't seem to me that they are intimidated by any type of censorship over the social media. But when it comes to real activism, real engagement in the community, of course there are limitations. Traditions to gender norms in their community, some of them are related to poverty, lack of resources, lack of ability. And some of them are related to being afraid of getting harassed by officials.
But some activists do publicly challenge Gaza's conservative policies, including those that restrict women's rights. In a modern cafe in Gaza City, 30-year-old journalist and blogger Asma Al-Khul says she's had personal encounters with the authorities. In 2011, she was arrested and beaten twice for covering and participating in demonstrations organized by a Palestinian youth movement.
All the time inside the jail, they threat me if I wrote the article about this. Something bad will happen for me and for my son. And this is my weak point. In February 2011, they also investigated with my father. In December 2010, they took my brother because of my writing. So in the end, I am watching myself, like there's censorship inside me. So I stopped writing because I cannot write in my blog with all these rules inside me and red lines.
Al-Khul has been recognized several times for her journalism, including the Courage in Journalism Award in 2012 from the International Women's Media Foundation. Although authorities have been successful in getting activists and especially women away from the streets, Al-Khul says she's happy to see online activism among women growing. But she says many focus on the Israeli occupation and neglect other problems in Palestinian society, such as honor crimes, early marriages, and political prisoners in Palestinian prisons.
There is some bloggers, they said we have all our rights and we don't have any problems as a woman in Gaza. And this is really sad. Always because we are Palestinian and because we should protect the resistance. So we shouldn't talk about our bad situation. But for how long we will be these liars?
Women's political involvement in society is also affected by the reality of day-to-day life in the occupied territories, says Sayan from UN Women. A recent report by the group concludes that the financial hardships created by the Israeli blockade are changing gender roles in Gaza.
Women are more economically active. Women are more assuming roles in the household than they used to, which is affecting their role in society and their position. Look, I mean, economic empowerment is key to political participation and political empowerment. So if we want women to pursue their freedom of expression, we need them to be empowered economically. We need them to be able to have a financial stability so they can basically ask for other rights.
Sayan says there's still a long ways to go. Although a growing number of women in Gaza are pursuing higher education and getting university degrees, more than 40% are unemployed. And with an overall poverty level also at 40%, many women in Gaza have more pressing concerns than activism, says Sayan. But the female bloggers that do exist say they'll continue to fight for greater equality, respect and dignity, both in the streets and online. Lina Otgor, FSRN, Gaza.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kalb. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.